The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
Welcome to Soundings. Dr. Robert Longsworth is a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center. Dr. Longsworth was educated at Duke University and at Harvard. He comes to the center from Oberlin College in Ohio, where he teaches courses in medieval English literature and serves as the dean of the College of Arts and Sciences. Dr. Longsworth has written on literature and society in the Middle Ages, about religion and drama, art and interpretation, and about Geoffrey Chaucer. At the National Humanities Center, Dr. Longsworth's research examines Middle English comedy. Dr. Longsworth, it's a pleasure to have you at the center, and welcome to the center's radio program, Soundings.
Let's begin with what I suppose would be a naive question. Why do people laugh?
Well, that's not at all a naive question. That's at the very heart of anybody's inquiry into comedy. Thomas Hobbes said the passion of laughter arises from a sudden glory, by which he apparently meant a perception on the part of the person who's laughing of some greatness in himself as compared to somebody else. And there's been a good deal of discussion of the notion that laughter is in fact a fairly vicious symptom of human behavior, that it represents a sense of superiority, chronic superiority. I think that probably is pretty largely unfair, but the fact that people have thought that way occasionally suggests, I think, that comedy has sometimes a dubious reputation. A person who laughs too much, too hard, and too protractedly is apt to be as suspect as a person who doesn't laugh at all. So I suppose that you have put your finger on the gist of the issue right at the outset. What provokes laughter in art, at any rate, is what interests me, and it interests me partly because, as a medievalist, I have worked for some time under the general opprobrious knowledge that people suppose that nobody laughed in the Middle Ages, or that if they did, they didn't laugh very hard. It was the age of calamity, as Barbara Tuchman has it in her book on the 14th century, and a period, therefore, when, because people must have realized they were suffering, they couldn't have laughed very much. In fact, precisely the reverse is true. People laugh at all times, in all situations, and at all manner of things. And part of my current interest is simply trying to make that, what to me is a palpable truth, apparent in terms of the Middle Ages.
Well, let's talk about laughter and society. What is the social function of comedy?
Comedy itself has so many different functions, only a few of which are probably social or related to the social order, that it's very difficult to try to nail it down to any one easily structured function.
So it's best to assign it to individual motivations and effects?
I think so. I think that comedy itself is, at least if we can talk about it as an artistic phenomenon, it is an effort on the part of a writer, a sculptor, an artist, painter, whatever, to put into a work of art some sense of incongruity that will seem that will be apparent to an onlooker or a hearer, and that will moreover move the onlooker to laughter. It's difficult to control that kind of response. A person may very well laugh at something today that would not have been found funny at all a few years ago. A Santa Claus dressed in a red uniform, shaking a bell beside an iron pot on a street corner doesn't make us laugh at all, but one suspects it would have made a medieval onlooker laugh uproariously to see such an insane representation of a human figure. We expect it. On the other hand, if the pillow slipped out of the belly of the Santa Claus, or if we saw the Santa Claus lying drunkenly in the gutter, then we would laugh too. The laughter is very much dependent on a perception of what is normal, what's to be expected at any given time, and therefore there's a constant tension in looking for comedy between what is there, what is actually there, what was intended to be put there, and what we supply out of our own sense of what is normative.
Well, if it's difficult to assign a social cause consistently to comedy, can you talk about social themes?
Occasionally, institutions find, and societies find, a need for the fool, or for a structure of folly of some sort. In our case, it seems to me that need is probably most conspicuously supplied in films and television by the sitcom or slapstick, something of that sort. In the medieval Feast of Fools, the boys or monks dressed up in the clothing of popes and bishops and then rode on donkeys or on the replication of donkeys, and more or less dispensed absurd orders and carried out a parody of what was a very serious ritual, you know, the regular religious ritual of the medieval church, which people took very seriously. So there appears to be within us as human beings a need to have a kind of relief from even the constant sense of seriousness about those things which we cherish most.
You know what, the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th centuries, are there themes there that we would find funny?
Certainly there are some things that are funny in all times and in all places. One of them is love. To the person who is not acting the part of the lover is always a figure of fun, at least in some of the activities that he or she carries on. Another of them, of course, is the social climber in any time or place. A person who acts in such a way as to pretend to be more or better placed socially than he or she is. And then also, I think, and perhaps most seriously of all, comic writers have at all times understood that you can simply get away with more trenchant, critical insight if you set your criticism in the context of comedy than if you do it in a context of serious attack on an institution. Thus, whatever the institution may be, though it changes over time, you can certainly very effectively ridicule it.
What are the institutions that we like to make fun of, that were made fun of as far back as the period that you're familiar with in the Middle Ages?
Well, one of them is certainly wealth and position. The comic writer has almost always found the wealthy and privileged an automatic target of fun. And one says, thank goodness for that. It's one of the redeeming qualities of comedy, I think. In the Middle Ages, for example, the wealthy and the highborn were the practitioners of whatever courtly life or chivalry was actually going on. The tellers of stories about chivalry and courtly life, though frequently they're designed to entertain even that audience itself, the courtly and chivalric one, love to make fun of conventions of chivalry and courtliness. In our own society, I think that probably the greatest American comedy writer must be Mark Twain. He was excellent at picking social targets. And it's interesting to me, has always been, that one of the devices that he was fond of, as exemplified in the Connecticut Yankee, is ridiculing the whole panoply of chivalric pretension, which Twain surely saw was a social milieu onto which he could very easily project the frailty, the foibles of social pretense in his own time. The court of King Arthur is only a little different, one supposes, than, say, the social register in New York at the end of the 19th century.
Well, comedy then appears to be primarily an issue of class.
It may often be that, but I don't think it is inevitably, probably. We do also indulge in comedy within a class, and some of the most effective comedy can, in fact, probably come out of a group of people who share a set of norms or understandings, and ridicule that, or use those as the basis for ridicule. This was something that Chaucer was a master of, for example, and Shakespeare. It really is one of the great geniuses of the British comic tradition, I think, that class is not the object of the most fruitful and genial kind of comedy. A Falstaff is not a class-ridden figure. A Wife of Bath is not notable because of her class, but because of sort of universal and irrepressible human tendencies in each of them that any one of us finds both funny and admirable in a strange way at the same time. What has troubled me about writers on the Middle Ages is that they have so much lost the sense of the comic enterprise that was then obviously abundant and much more in evidence than we have ever supposed it to be. If my suspicion is correct, we tend to lose our as part of our inheritance a rich texture of comedy and remake it all for ourselves. This may not be a bad thing, but it certainly suggests to me that that one generation tends to forget that the prior generation laughed as well as that it cried and was angry and did things of which it need not be proud. And that points up another tendency in comedy, I think, probably, which is its tendency to be conservative to some extent. It doesn't laugh, you don't laugh at a funeral, but you may laugh on the way home.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings. Putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Dr. Robert Longsworth, a resident scholar at the National Humanities Center, teaches at Oberlin College in Ohio, where he specializes in English literature of the Middle Ages. Dr. Longsworth's publications deal with medieval drama, and his research at the center focuses on comic elements in Middle English romances. My discussion with Dr. Longsworth for Soundings, the center's radio program, is about comedy and society in the Middle Ages and in the present.
It provides a sane perspective on all our human activities. If we always had to live at the pitch of concern and engagement under which we live when we hear of an earthquake or when we are fighting a war in Vietnam, life would become intolerable, surely. Laughter is what makes it tolerable to us. When we can laugh at what we did at the funeral or in Vietnam or at some of the absurdities that happened when the earthquake occurred, then we have distanced ourselves a little bit from it. And at the same time, in a curious sort of way, we've made it part of our heritage. Laughter does not inevitably, in fact, generally, I think it does not so much repudiate the object of the laughter as it embraces it and makes it part of our common human experience. It's a very odd and delightful aspect, I think, of our common humanity. If I may return to my hobby horse of the Middle Ages, again, in the 14th century, when such comic geniuses as Boccaccio and Chaucer were writing, there was a great flourishing of comedy. These writers were among the greatest comic writers of all time, I suppose. And yet, the catalog of events at the time against which they were writing was staggering. In fact, as you're probably aware, the Decameron, the Hundred Tales, were told by a group of people who fled Florence during the plague.
What did people laugh at in the Middle Ages? Was the sense of humor, for instance, in the Middle Ages more sophisticated than it is now?
No, I don't think it was more sophisticated, probably. People in the Middle Ages would appear to have been able to laugh, however, at virtually everything. The place perhaps best to understand this is the medieval drama. In the drama, practically everything is susceptible of comedy. There's a great deal more comedy in this in these plays than one would suspect, particularly given their theme. They deal with the Bible. You know, the medieval drama was originally an effort to educate the uneducated about the Bible, about this heritage of their Christian religion. And yet, repeatedly, scenes of the broadest and sometimes lowest sort of comedy are introduced. Cain is a comic figure in the later dramas, as he argues with God about whether or not he should give his tithe, and as he decides finally to kill Abel, whom he resents because Abel is such a nice young boy. There is, in nearly anything we take seriously, a comic side, I think, because what we find in what we take most seriously is our own desire to become better, to improve the lot of the race or our own lot. And as we seek to envision what it would be to be better, we're really thinking of what it would be to be different. And if we perceive the difference, then we come back to that point, I think, that comedy begins with the perception of difference between this figure and what we've come to expect. All right, in the acting out of the story of Cain and Abel, here is an act of fratricide, the original act of fratricide that foretold for a medieval audience the death of Christ himself. And the medieval audience would have seen that in the play, and yet the behavior of Cain partly draws attention to all the frailty in our common human nature, and if we can laugh at it, we can divest ourselves of it a little bit exactly.
So this is a way of laughing at the villains and,
sure.
and getting rid of what troubles us.
Yes.
Does it bring out the intellectual in the audience, in the viewer, to enjoy comedy?
Well, Horace Walpole, you know, said that life itself is a comedy to those who think and a tragedy to those who feel. I don't believe that we can laugh unless we are capable of perceiving the difference between what is going on and what we normally expect. And in that sense, just because it requires an act of mind, I suppose comedy does tend to be more intellectual than some kinds of human experience. But it would be easy to overemphasize the importance of the cultivation of intellect.
How would you describe the relationship between the comic writer and his audience?
The best comic writer is probably born with a gift, has the intuition, a sort of native savvy about what is and what is not normative, and from that is able to build a kind of comic genius. Now, not every comic writer, however, is altogether at one with his or her audience. Jonathan Swift, I think, is an excellent example of a distinguished comic writer who was acutely aware of his being at variance with the temper of the times, even his audience. And it may have been that sense that he and his audience were antagonists rather than partners that enabled him to write such brilliant satire. On the other hand, Chaucer is an extremely genial figure. I think probably most of Shakespeare's comic figures reflect the same kind of geniality, a tolerance for human folly that makes of it an occasion for revelry rather than an occasion for condemnation.
But in either case, it's possible for the audience or the reader strongly to identify with one or the other, which is to say the good guy or the bad guy.
Oh yes, I think usually the audience has to be taken into account by the writer. Either the writer wants to alienate the audience or to attract the audience. Mm-hmm. There is either a seduction or a repulsion going on the part of the writer in the use of the comic material, and the comic figures themselves are either attractive or repulsive to the writer.
You've mentioned several times the notion of the social norm. Do we have a social norm today that our comic writers adhere to or deviate from?
Oh yes, we have numerous norms. I think each one of us walks around daily with a set of expectations in his or her head about how every other person we encounter should act or respond. And if something occurs that is slightly at variance from that, whether it's somebody who spills the teacup or somebody who's forgotten to close the zipper in his trousers, we recognize that something has happened there that isn't quite what's to be expected. Now, we find that sometimes, if we lack a sense of humor, perhaps, worthy only of condemnation. In that case, we become funny, probably. But that's all grist for the mill. So that race, for example, which is a great problem for us today, and in a fundamental way, is also a natural subject for comedy. So that my argument would be that comedy can be made out of the smallest things, or it can be made out of the most fundamental issues that confront us as human beings, and that in any case, what is common to both, at whatever level you invade the comedy, is our effort to perceive what is normative and what falls away from the normative.
Professor Longsworth, how would you define a term like the human comedy?
I wouldn't.
It's impossible?
No, I think probably what's been meant when that term has been used is that we are a people that we are a species of animal that is capable of dreaming And we're perfectly aware that we fall short of our dreams. In that sense, we're all comic figures because we don't come up to what we expect. And I think that that probably, that must be, at any rate, in the most charitable sense, what is usually meant by the term.
Final question. What would be your favorite example of medieval comedy or the comic element? What do you enjoy most?
Well, I think the first and most important thing to learn, if you're going to look at medieval literature, is that for the most part, it was written to be told. Storytelling is largely a lost art today, but there resides in storytelling an enormous capacity for mirth, for enjoyment, that the dull page itself does not communicate. So what means most to me in reading medieval literature is reading it aloud and allowing it to work on me as a reader, understanding that that's probably what was intended in the first place. Not that I should go off and read it in the privacy of my own boudoir, but rather that I should read it to somebody, or be read to by a skillful minstrel or a performer.
Do you have a favorite example?
Well, yes, the Canterbury Tales. They're all stories that are told, and they're told by this crazy group of improbable people who are going on a religious pilgrimage to while away the time. And that more or less is the way we enjoy ourselves most, telling stories with one another. What Chaucer has done, however, in throwing that group of people together, improbable as they are, and giving to them each a story that to some extent reflects the nature of the pilgrim, the storyteller, himself or herself, and then allowing those stories to bounce off one another is to produce a vast panorama of comedy about the social scene that characterized late 14th century England. So the whole enterprise begins with the knight, the noblest of all the pilgrims, telling a lovely story about two men who love the same woman. And it's sentimental, it's gushy, it's everything you would not expect to be coming out of the mouth of a man who had spent his entire life hammering at people with his sword and being hammered at by a sword. The pilgrim who responds is tired of the gush. It's the miller. And the miller tells that fabulously bawdy tale about two men who love the same woman. But the upshot of that doesn't bear repeating, I'm sure, over the airwaves.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the center is William Bennett. Soundings is distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
This is Bill Bennett, Director of the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, with an invitation for you to listen to Soundings, the Center's radio program. Soundings this week presents an overview of comedy and society in medieval and modern times in a conversation with Dr. Robert Longsworth, a scholar in residence at the Center and an expert on the literature of the Middle Ages. Professor Longsworth sheds light on what some people call the Dark Ages. Join us this week for Soundings.